Hey guys, welcome. I'm very proud and happy to have Adrian Day of Adrian Day Asset Management, founder, CEO, and a very specific global outlook as well. And this being the day that we're actually expecting Jay Powell to speak as well, it's very pertinent to get his take on all things global and maybe a little bit of Fed speak as well. Adrian, delighted to have you. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Francis. Been a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm looking really forward to this. So, it's become a super interesting space because it does look like there's the, for the first time, and we've said many people personally in our in-house view, people are going to call the pivot too soon. And we've had pivot callers from last year, mid-year, but now we've had the first real set of incidents that saw the short end of the bond market get particularly volatile, a little bit of a reversal on that yield curve inversion, which went to an almost an extreme low that's of the modern generation. You have to go pre-80s to see a deeper inversion. What's your take generally? What's the pressure points? What should people be watching in terms of global macro right now?
Okay. Clearly how tight central banks around the world are going to be, and of course we know some central banks are acting tighter than others, but that to me is the main thing. How tight are they going to continue to be as things in the economy and the financial system start to break? And that to me is the critical question.
And your assessment is we've started to see some of that breakage in terms of we've had the second and third largest bank failures essentially in Signature and Silicon Valley Bank. And of course, as I mentioned, we got quite a high amount of volatility showing up in the bonds and debt markets. Is this the point? Because we've formed a view, but I'm interested in your take on that.
Yeah, no, I think last week was critical. It was critical in two ways. It was critical because things started to break. And a lot of people have been saying for a long time that with the sort of rapid interest rate hikes we've had in the U.S., I'll just say U.S. for now, from zero lower bound to 4.5 in less than a year, that is an exceptionally aggressive rate of increase. And it's even more aggressive, you could look at it as being even more aggressive than Paul Volcker, because rates were double digit when he came in to begin with. So the most aggressive interest rate hike certainly since 1980. And a lot of people have been saying, I've been saying, but you cannot expect that without A, the economy slowing and moving into a recession, and B, something somewhere breaking. And you and I and all your listeners know, you know, we've had 12 years of absolutely extremely loose monetary policy in the US, in Europe in particular, in Britain, and in Japan, of course. We've had extremely loose policy. And during loose policy, with interest rates so low, we all know people borrow money they shouldn't borrow, they make bad investments, they buy things they shouldn't buy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that means, as Warren Buffett famously said, when the tide goes out, we'll see who's swimming naked. Well, when interest rates go up, we'll see who's over-leveraged. And so last week was critical to me. It was critical because we saw the first, you know, major significant breakages, if you like, in the financial system. And we saw the response of central banks, both the Swiss Central Bank and the Fed, not so much the ECB, but even Britain was trying to get in on this, of just pumping money. We know what central banks do when there's a problem. They throw money at it. And so in 10 minutes, if you like, or 24 hours, whatever you want to say, the Fed undid half of all the QT, all the quantitative tightening that they had done in the last year.
Yeah, that says a lot. And we're of a similar view. We pointed out that the energy complex, I'm going to take you a little bit outside of, I suppose, the interest rates and the Fed, we had natural gas at a massive head and shoulders that had touched 10 in the prelude to the German, the European winter. You know, there was all the possibility of lights going out because of not buying Russian gas, et cetera, et cetera. And in actual fact, we saw a technical reversal in December that triggered, and we've collapsed to sub $3 on gas from highs of 10, and the triggering trade was 5.4. And we've also seen setups now in Western Texas Intermediate Tech, technically, that suggest a substantial plummet. I'm talking 40% in our view. I'm not asking you to concur with that, but that's technically based. And similarly in uranium. So am I correct in assuming, is there any other way that you get such a high degree of demand energy price drops without some degree of demand destruction in terms of recession, or maybe even worse, you know, more lockdowns or freedom of movement, climate lockdowns or something else that could take us in an stagflationary environment, and we consider it to be a hyperstagflationary environment, so low on oil to drop. And is that also a bit of an indicator? And just to add slightly to what's already quite a complex question, it feels to me like we have two economies, the consumer who is wrecked, and oil prices very contingent on that, how much they're buying from Amazon, packaging, delivery, flying on holidays, business travel, etc. But then on the other hand, we see a very buoyant military industrial complex, and we see government almost crowding out private and retail money as the primary participants in everything. What's your take on all that I threw there?
Well, that is a huge, huge subject you've just raised. I think, first of all, you're absolutely right. The big collapse in natural gas, and of course, there were other factors like the weather in Europe didn't get quite as bad as it could have done. But you're absolutely right. That signals demand destruction. And honestly, Francis, you were right on natural gas, and I was wrong. And I wish I'd listened to you. I wish I'd listened to you back at the end of last year. But there's no question that there's two economies, and there's two economies in many ways. I mean, in the U.S., we've had a much widening wealth gap caused by government policy, caused by Federal Reserve policy. And all the socialists that go on about the wealth gap and blaming the bankers and blaming people who make money are missing the point. The Federal Reserve, with their policies, caused this widening wealth gap. But here in the U.S., for example, I mean, the lower 50% in terms of income and household wealth are really beginning to struggle. And we're seeing savings virtually eliminated, and we're seeing credit card debt at 20-year highs, and we're beginning to see credit card defaults. And so it's only going to be a few months before we start to see consumer spending, and we're already seeing indicators from
Amazon. Subprime cars out of that as well, with a couple of companies already collapsing that were very much geared towards the subprime vehicle market as well. And the denial of finance for new refi and purchases. So that whips the demand carpet out from under people's feet, because invariably, particularly in the States, people don't even understand the payment, the value of the car. They just want a manageable payment. They're not even always sure how much they're actually spending in full. So they're very reliant on payment finance.
Absolutely true. It's funny. When you go to buy a car in the U.S., they say, how much can you afford? Well, 100, 180,000, 100. No. How much do you want your monthly payment to be? You're absolutely right. Which is backwards way of looking at it. But it's a lot of people think that way. You know, people will say to me, I need $5,000 a month in my retirement. You know, I ask them if they want to be conservative or aggressive. I need $5,000 a month. How aggressive do you need to be to get $5,000 a month off my X that I'm giving you? And I say, that's working backwards. I can't just pull a return without taking risk. But anyway, to get to the broader point, and yet at the same time, the government is spending money, continues to spend money like crazy. You mentioned a military-industrial complex. They're certainly doing well. But you just have to look at the stock market in the U.S. and other countries. Many countries still continuing to do very well, which in the face of higher interest rates and in the face of a slowing, let's just say slowing economy, that's probably more than slowing, but a slowing economy and things beginning to break. And we didn't mention Credit Suisse, of course, but that's another, no. but we know, yeah. I mean, to think that Credit Suisse basically defaulted, you know, this is much more significant than Silicon Valley Bank, which most people have never heard of.
Yeah.
To think that in the face of all of that, the stocks are doing so well, shows you a few things, I think. It shows you the wealth disparity, but the upper 10% still have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And frankly, when I look at the stock market, that is one of the big positive factors to offset my various negative factors. The other thing it shows you is a huge degree of complacency. I honestly don't know what it's like in England right now. But in the U.S., there is, I can only call it extreme complacency about things. And we can talk about that later if you like. So, yeah, I mean, it shows that people are not really focused on the risk right now.
The complacency I see when you talk, look at technicals, that's very interesting, is that we had real volatility on the debt markets. In the MOVE index, and you have almost benign indifference in the VIX. And that just further, that's a technical manifestation of exactly what you're saying. Because when I think you say complacency, you're referring to the average guy and their 401ks, and of course the high end of the market, the multimillionaires that have huge holdings in equity. They, you know, it's almost like we're in the best place, even if there's a bit of stuff bouncing around. Every time it dips, it only ever goes up because they'll print more money. It is an inflationary environment. What the hell, me carry on?
Right. No, absolutely. And of course, you mentioned the volatility in the bond markets. Bond markets typically are more astute at reading market signals, I think, have been,
yes,
than stock markets. So when I talk about complacency, I'm talking much more about the equity market.
Correct.
Yeah. But you're right. The other factor that's very important, I can speak for myself. I mean, I was investing in the 1970s, not as a professional money manager, but I was investing and I was writing on investments. But most managers today, you know, even if they're 55 years old, they've only had 30 years in the business, right? After they got out of MBA or whatever they got. And during those 30 years, the lesson has been, buy the dips, the Fed will bail us out. Buy the dips, the Fed will bail us out. And those dips are becoming shorter and shallower. They're not even waiting for a 20 to 25% dip right now.
Yeah. And I think that's a meme, isn't it? You know you're in a crazy world when a 30-year meme isn't the new investment strategy, which is why value is such an interesting concept. And it's been a very hard thing to actually implement in this we've had a financialization of everything, haven't we? I mean, we were talking about cars. Daniel DiMartino Booth was actually saying you go not 70 months, you can do 90 months now on vehicles. But we've also seen the housing market turn. We've passed peak boomer retirement in December last year. So we're getting more people pivoting into being takers instead of contributors at a taxation point of view in terms of their welfare, their Medicaid. And of course, they are going to be downgraders, less expenditure, more maintain existing lifestyle and cover costs, but not buying Ferraris and kids through private schools, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got this big demographic that's going to actually be distributing. Surely we're going to start to see, given the multiples on equity and the extremities of the multiples on housing in this new interest rate environment, asset price underperformance in equity and homes, just as the biggest demographic goes into retirement. And those coming up under them don't get into the ladder or onto the ladder because A, the banks are going to be more cautious right now in this environment. B, they don't have the same amount that the boomers have had in terms of pump and dump cycles to actually accumulate wealth. through their stock portfolios and 401k. So it feels like you're going to have a lot of underperforming asset classes for a sustained period in this, in an environment of actually hyperstagflation. So the cost of things going to remain stubbornly strong. We called for the bond market to have turned on the March 2020 events in around August 2020, and everyone thought we were mad. They were talking, oh, it's Japanification, it's deflation only, et cetera, et cetera. Bonds, bonds, bonds. We could still do NERP or ZERP. And now it seems much more people have come to our side of the view now that we've actually had a change in debt because currency is borrowed into existence and the intermediation thereof is banks. So here we have a crisis of debt, banks, and currency at the moment, and they all seem to come together. They're the holy trinity, the evil trinity, if we can, of the current overly financially leveraged system. Is that the beginning of the closing down and the roll into a reset? And is that also the reasons why we're seeing gold getting such a firm bid and even Bitcoin for the crypto boys getting a turn in the market?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I won't use the word reset because that, of course, has different implications. We can come to that if you want. But yeah, I think so. I mean, while people, you know, I'm a historian by training. And, you know, you look at the bull bond market that we had from 1980, when interest T-bills in the U.S. were paying 20%, yielding 20%. We've had this 40-year bull market in bonds. Now, bond markets tend to be long. They tend to be longer than equity. Cycles. So we've had this 40 years, but not just a normal bond market cycle. We went to this ridiculous, but unbelievable situation of negative interest rates. So we had lowest interest rates in all of human history. And of course, during that period, asset prices went higher. And of course, when interest rates are so low, you expect the sort of financialization of everything, and you expect all of that when interest rates are so abnormally low. I think right now, we could easily be in a 30 or at the dawn of a 30 or 40 year bond bear market. I'm not sure rates are going to 20% again. But a situation where rates at least return to a normal and as always go above normal, upward normal in quotes. And during that period, valuations are going to return to something more appropriate if you want. And just to give an example, I mean, I've been talking to some people yesterday. I'll just look at the S&P over here. The S&P right now is trading at almost 18 times earnings. Let's just get it exact on my Bloomberg. So there you are. It's 17.99 times earnings, 18 times earnings. I've had so many people say to me, the S&P is now back to good valuations. I say, you're crazy. Not to my clients, but to other people. You're crazy. 18 times earnings multiple is good only in comparison with the last few years and the dot-com era. On a historical basis, 18 times earnings multiple for stocks, but are yielding, what are we yielding? We're yielding less than 2%. That's expensive. And so I go up to say, and if you look around the world, even the markets that by comparison look very undervalued right now, Hong Kong, Britain looks cheap. But on a historical basis, if you go back 50 years, the valuations are not quite so cheap. Maybe Britain and Hong Kong are like the best examples because they both got special situations. But you can look at a lot of markets right now, Switzerland, Canada. Yeah. They're at the high end.
Generally,
of
Europe. Yeah. American markets seem just ridiculously, and I put it down to maybe the tech, having such a fulcrum in tech for the Western world. And I also say that PEs on tech gets superseded in a much faster way and should be treated far more riskily because you can quantum leap one technology. I mean, Xerox, Polaroid, all of these are examples of tech being, you know, as opposed to an electricity provider or a railroad, these things can get superseded quite dramatically and caught out and left limp. In fact, Apple itself almost died, as you'll probably remember, the post-Steve Jobs era. So it's quite a phoenix. It's one of those rare events that actually the day was saved. And I think the multiples are ridiculously high. And that we did a market cap per citizen population. That's quite a rough, granular detail. But there's about 330 million people in the States. And there was the total market cap of the NASDAQ and the Wall Street, the Dow, etc. And we came out that each person is sustaining over $100,000 of market cap, each citizen. Now, if you go to Russia, which is incredibly resource and energy rich, you're around 3,000. India was about $1,900. Japan was about 39,000 and coming down because you know how hypervalued they got in the 90s. So I always think of Japan a kind of, to some degree, not to be overly associative, but there's an element that it's 11 years ahead of the US. And it's already substantially lower than it once was at the 90s. I would love to have known what that measure was when the Nikkei was 40 plus, etc. So we're actually, it's quite a granular measure, but in terms of people, demographics, and ability to hold up a market cap, it's quite a tell that the US is so. And you will say, yes, but there were more capitalists. And one of the reasons for those premiums was, capitalistic meritocracy, a lot of these things, and rule of law and property rights. And now we're seeing a lot of these things undermined. I mean, I'm referring to the currency that was seized of Russia, for example, as one instance in case, which is causing nervousness of the dollar. So surely that premium should also be dissipating the more they are dwindling from the original reasons why they commanded that premium.
Yeah, no. I agree with everything you've said. I just can't really add much to that. I mean, but you mentioned Japan, for example. You know, Japan obviously is an outlier in this, no question. But I think people need to be reminded, you know, the Nikkei in 1987 was a 40,000. For most of the next 40 years, it has traded at less than 50% of that peak. And we are still today below where we were from 1988 to 1990. We are still below that level. And, you know, people in England, people in Europe, people in America, North America, most people have not experienced a bear market. They don't know what a bear market is. 2020 wasn't a bear market, for goodness sake. People talk about it being a bear market. You know, it lasts out 2 months.
Left crash. Yeah.
Yeah. 1987 wasn't a bear market. Even 2008-09, you know, when you look back at a chart, it's difficult to, it's just a blip on the chart right now.
Correct.
You know, a bear market, Japan would be a bear market. Even the U.S. market from 1966 to 1982, where it took till 1982 before the U.S. market rose above the levels of 1966.
Which is a very important point. It is. I wanted to add that to our bond cycle has turned, because essentially all that 82 period through till today, you actually had one of the longest bond market phases, but you've also had nothing but, as we said, a buy the dip equity bull market. I mean, everybody makes a great deal of Warren Buffett, and he has immense talent, so I'm not trying to deride him, but he has been a net long equities during the biggest equity bull market, and he always was sufficiently capitalized to sit through dips and treat them as buying opportunities. That is the right man at the right time in cycle, isn't it? Because essentially he sat through a 40-year occasional dipping market, which actually, as you mentioned, when you go up to the monthly chart, are nothing more than little squiggles on a hyperbolic chart. So he's been a net accumulator on dips of value stocks in an environment where you've had a 40-year bond and equity bull market. So everything we say about the potential for bonds to go into stagnation, the stubbornly high interest rates, chop and churn somewhere around 5s, 6s, and 7s, possibly for an extended period, really recessional feel, applies also to equities, for which the Nikkei, I think, is the parallel you were making as well, as I suggested. You're just not seeing, you're not going to see these highs for decades, and money devaluation will be the reason you will eventually regain them in decades.
Right, right. Well, you know, Jeremy Grantham from GMO does very good work. And I honestly can't think of the numbers right now. But, you know, you can look at the market at any given point in time and say, if you buy now, how long on average you can expect it to take before you make a certain return. And people buying the market right now, you know, are probably looking at least a decade before they make a return that beats money market funds. So people, and that's not to say there are not today and will not be in the future pockets of value. It doesn't mean there won't be trading opportunities. It certainly doesn't mean there won't be some assets, and you mentioned gold, that are worth buying. It's just that buying the broad equity market right now, you've got the odds against you. And you're certainly not going to get the kind of returns in the next decade that we had in the last decade. And pension funds looking for 8% on their money in order to meet, and insurance companies are not going to do it without, as we saw in Britain in September, without taking extraordinary risk, which might mean leverage. It might mean reaching for yield. You know, one other thought, if I may, with jumping, I've been jumping around a bit here. I'm sorry. You're trying to keep
sure.
Track. I'm jumping around. But, you know, one of the worst things that the Fed did and the European Central Bank and the Bank of England, by keeping rates so low for so long, they hurt savers. They hurt the people that were doing the right thing, the people that didn't have a lot of debt, the people that saved money, the people that bought things rather than borrowed money to buy things. And those people, the worst part of all of that is those people who had planned for retirement could not retire comfortably, could not live in retirement on the savings that they had. And so they had to stretch for yield. And that might mean buying very volatile tech stocks. It might mean, you know, leverage. It might mean all sorts of stuff. You know, I've had people in retirement buying three times NASDAQ ETFs because the NASDAQ's going up, so why not multiply it by three? You know, and that is the worst thing that I think the worst result of what the central banks did over the experiment with low interest rates.
Yes. And it's funny, I'm reading a book on a totally unrelated topic about surrounding micro habits. And it's all about postponing gratification. How when we were, you know, predators, animals are looking for the instant, they're living in the moment, immediate food danger, everything is for the moment. And we work jobs for a paycheck later. We are having to work in a society for deferred compensation, saving for a pension and all of this. And yet we still have, if we've been in existence, as this person suggests, for hundreds of thousands of years as humans, we still have this instant gratification or let's get there fast, this impatience. And it reminds me of the marshmallow test for the kids for who will be successful in life. The buy the car now and the shotgun finance to show status, all of these principles. And it seems like this has been encouraged. And as you were saying, the prudent person, personal finance people have been crushed and missed the extremity of gains, but their prudence will pay now on the second half of the cycle. They just might have spent their entire life, though, watching shoot from the hip guys make a lot of alpha on those the booming cycle in financial engineering, only to see them get washed up later. and be very glad that eventually their prudence might pay. It's a different culture, isn't it? You know, trying to get things fast.
Yeah. But as you say, I mean, I think it's human nature, and you know, the Anglo-Saxon societies tend to be more prudent with finances. I think that's fair to say. The Latin temperament tends to be more, you know, today. But yeah. But the reckoning is coming, unfortunately. And I don't mean to sound like a preacher, but
when
rates move up, a lot of things will break. And you know, the other thing that's critical for people to understand, because again, I've had people say to me, look, suddenly at the end of last year, people were saying, hey, the Fed's raised rates for 8 months in a row now. You know, everything's fine. The consumer's still spending. You know, what's the problem? And Powell himself, Jerome Powell, Fed head, has said it. But remember what Milton Friedman was very adamant about, that monetary policy works with lower variable lags. And variable is an important part of that because it affects interest rate sensitive sectors like automobiles and housing, just as you've mentioned. Everybody buys on debt, borrows the money. So those sectors get affected first. And we've seen a lot of damage in those markets already. We saw it last June, July, August, we were seeing damage in housing and automobiles, and we're just seeing more of it now with the news today or Carvana. But other sectors of the economy, those lags take longer, sometimes a year or 18 months. And so, you know, I mentioned retail sales earlier. That's a good example. You know, retail sales in the U.S. were up marginally last year. And everybody pointed, the apologists pointed to that being a sign of a healthy economy. Well, when prices have gone up 8 to 10%, and volume consumer sales have gone up 2%, it means people are spending less in real terms. Now, think about a real family. What happens? You've got a husband working, you've got a wife working, maybe she's, I don't know. We'll just say a part-time job. They've got two kids. And, you know, they can just about survive paycheck to paycheck. Then prices start to go up. The first inclination is to continue spending because your kids still want their Snap, Crackle, Pop for breakfast. So you continue buying it. Then you have to sort of start cutting back a little bit. Instead of Kellogg's, you buy, you know, the store brand that's cheaper. And instead of buying the clothes at wherever, TJ Maxx, you have to go to Walmart. So you're still buying, but you're shrinking, you know, you're getting less of quality. And then you start to spend your savings. And then you say, honey, I don't think we're going to be able to take the summer holiday this year, but I can still buy the kids their clothes. Well, suddenly the savings go out. Then the next step is you can't pay off your credit card debt. And your balance starts building. And that's without anyone losing their job. You know, if one of the two earners loses their job, it's a much more rapid and sharp deterioration. So the point I'm making is that the very long and variable lags, you can see it working in a real life situation. It takes 12 months before consumers cut back on spending, right? They should have cut back a year ago, but you know, you don't want to, and you can't, and
habits are difficult to change. Yeah.
Yeah. But it takes a year before that consumer spending will start to decline. And the same thing for companies that borrowed money. A company that borrowed money, most US corporations, large corporations, have termed out their debt fairly significantly. So a lot of debt doesn't come due until 24, 25, 26. For smaller companies, though, you know, a lot of smaller companies borrow on rates of reset every year. Maybe a smaller company had a two-year loan that they borrowed. Well, that money was spent. They didn't borrow the money and just stick it in the bank. They use that money to buy things, to expand, to pay, give people salary raises, or whatever it is. But when 2 years comes up, they're going to have to refinance, and they're going to have to refinance at a much higher rate than they did in the last. So the point I'm making is that all of these things work with these long and variable lags. And I would say, I think it's important to really understand or to really grasp that the rate increases that we have already seen in Europe, in America, we have not yet seen the economic impact of what has already been done. So even if the Fed pauses right now, just pauses and never raises rates again, we've still got more damage to come.
Yeah, the domino chain has already started, and that you just don't stop it. And I think we're seeing the early part of it. I think it just gets worse from here in truth. Portfolio for reset. How should people position? So we all understand the problem. Many of this has been discussed. We seem to be in a large amount of agreement. And as with we are hearing a lot of the aspects that mean that this is pointing to further contagion. How should people position? What's your ideal portfolio? So I've got my $1 million. I'm coming to Adrian Day Asset Management. Where are you putting me, and how should we play? And what would be a general? This is on a non-advisory basis. Speak freely. This is, yeah, you know, take it with and assess and non-advisory.
Sure. And of course, it's different for each person, which is what you're saying. I mean, the first thing I would say to people is right now, you absolutely want to hang on to a lot of cash. You don't need to spend all that money right now. And a lot of people will say, look, you know, even if we get a T-bill, you know, and we're earning 4% on our treasury, we're still losing money to inflation. Understood. But I think right now, you don't want to be buying aggressively right now. That's the first thing. So where would I put the money? I mean, I'll start with gold, because I think gold is the most certain asset to do well over the next 2 to 3 years without trading, right? We're not talking about trading now.
We're talking investment. So 50 years old. Let me tighten up the scenario. 50 years old, $1 million, male. Many of our viewers will be there or thereabouts, and there's $1 million. How much gold? Are we dividing the pie into quarters, or what we're going to do? Some cash, some gold. What percentages?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think you need some bullion just as an insurance policy, as a hedge. And people often will have that separate from what they give me to manage.
Okay.
But I tell you, we're very high on gold right now. We're 25% to 30% in gold equities.
Yeah.
I also am buying selectively and trading a little bit more some of the other commodities. So right now, as we talk, not buying a lot of anything right now as we talk. But let's say, you know, last month I was buying copper stocks. Or 2 weeks ago I was buying the copper stocks. I think copper is quite attractive, but I think you have to trade these things. You mentioned uranium earlier, but we've been buying the uranium trust, you know, the Sprott physical uranium,
yes.
not the equities, and trading it. So I would put another 10% into other types of resources. Copper would be my number one. Well, silver, copper. The renewables, if you want to, you know, put them in that bucket, a little bit different from the other commodities. But I agree with you, in a severe global slowdown, we're going to have demand destruction. And, you know, EV is a great new source of demand for copper and nickel and other rare earths and so on.
Cobalt, yeah.
But it's offset by a decline in traditional uses if the economy's in a recession. So we're being selective, we're being a little cautious, but we're also trading them a little bit more. So there's 25 to 30 in gold. And of course, a lot of gold stocks do have other components.
Yeah,
Frank Barter, for example, has 20% in oil and gas. Royalty. Yep. It's a royalty company. Another 10% in other commodities. So I would have a little bit, frankly, in real global blue chips, maybe 10%, in real global blue chips, that you can be pretty confident that the company isn't going anywhere. So, for example, Nestle. You know, you could have a recession, you could have a depression, and Nestle, I think, will survive, and they will still pay a dividend. You know, they've increased their dividend, something like 38 out of the last 40 years, and the two they didn't increase it, they kept it stable. So, and that's been on the back of an increase in revenue every year. So, you're not going to get rich off it. And I think it's important that if we have a 10% allocation to these global blue chips, preferably dividend-paying stocks, definitely dividend-paying stocks, it's important to realize that segment will be hurt if there is a sharp market decline. Now, it might come back quicker, and again, to mention Nestle, you only have to look at 2008-09, the stock went down about 50% at the beginning in 2008, but it came back much sooner than most of the market and continued to favor dividend. So that's another 10%. I would have 10%, particularly for a U.S. person, in high dividend paying as a particular sector of the U.S. market called business development companies, but are companies that lend money to small or medium-sized businesses, and they don't pay any tax at the corporate level. They distribute everything to shareholders. And these companies, contrary to what the fear is, these companies can do well during downturns, during recessions, and during a period of rising interest rates. They tend to have very low cap leverage. A bit BDC by law can only have 2-to-1 leverage, but most of them are about 1.2, 1.3. So very low leverage. And unlike the banks, very importantly, they tend to match duration on their debt, on their capital, with duration of the loans that they make. So they don't have those two huge risks of the market. In an extreme recessionary environment, some of the businesses that they've left money to will not be able to repay the debt. But these companies, the best of them, all have, you know, workout groups and they say, and it's not just a slogan, but we're a partner with the people we lend money to. 2000, the whole COVID lockdown issue is perhaps not the best example, but you look at companies like Ares Capital, which is the largest of the BDCs, it's a $10 billion market cap. These companies tend to be small, but Ares at $10 billion is the largest. And even smaller ones like Gladstone Capital, which is about $330 million market cap, they were all able to continue generating their revenue and paying their dividend without borrowing money to pay the dividend.
Yeah,
which is the most foolish thing I've ever heard. They were all able to do that throughout the lockdown period, which is not a very long test, but I think it's a pretty dramatic test. And these companies are yielding anywhere from 9 to 11% right now, because the stocks have been hurt because people, you know, they sold off with the banks, which they shouldn't have done. So anyway, that's another 10% that will pay us a good dividend, even on very volatile stocks. The stocks are very, very volatile, but the dividends, distributions, I should say, tend to be fairly consistent in different economic environments. So that's another 10%. And with the rest, I would look at the rest as cash. We'll put a lot in T-bills, with $1 million, we'll put some in 1 month's T-bills, and we'll put some in 4 or 6 month T-bills. And we will just look for opportunities as they arise. I mean, frankly, I think some of the British stocks are good value right now.
You did mention that, if I can jump in. I want to give you an analogy that was really interesting. When I came to the UK in 1999, about 6 months before the millennium turnover and the river of fire and all of that, Tony Blair was bragging about the sixth stock market, and it was 6,920 or 30. And I think today we're only just through the 7,000s. You know, we're in the low 7,000s. I should actually check where it is. But essentially, you've had 23 years, in fact, I'd argue 23 and a half years almost, going on a quarter of a century, and you've barely made 1%, 10%, 2% or 2% in that era. Obviously, the constitutes components of the FTSE 100 have adjusted somewhat, but when I came over, Vodafone was the big king. You might remember that era of Chris Gent and Radi Raw and all the acquisitions and et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, what a king's Vodafone was. And of course, it's fallen angels for some of these mobile telephony companies. And then there was HSBC, and of course, now banking's been hit. So I tend to agree, even though I don't have huge optimism for the British economy per se, I'm surprised there aren't more events of US companies with super high valuated stock doing the Cadbury's purchase, as happened by, I can't remember which American confectionery company now that bought Cadbury's, but I'm surprised there's not a lot more of that going on.
I'm very, very surprised, to be honest. But yeah, so I agree with you. I agree with everything you said. You know, price, of course, is not anywhere near as important as value, right? We know that. I think it was Oscar Wilde who talked about people who know the price of everything and the value of nothing. But but the stock market today is lower than it was 5 years ago and 20 years ago. 10 times single digit earnings multiple on the whole market. The whole market today, because it's dropped significantly today, but the whole market today is 9.5 times earnings multiple, 1.6 times book, 1.1 times price to sales. I mean, these are in, what's the yield? I mean, look, the yield is 4.3%. So on a valuation basis, not looking at anything else, not looking at its historical valuations, not looking at the economy, just on a valuation basis today, as a snapshot, those are pretty darn good valuations. And of course, those are the averages. So some stocks are cheaper, some are higher. But I think, I agree with you on the UK economy. And I mean, if the Federal Reserve spent too much money since COVID, I mean, Rishi Sunak, who's now the responsible party, he likes to say, you know, he was spending money like a drunken sailor during COVID. At least that's my impression.
Yes.
I think a lot of the negative. So my view is there's some really good quality companies in Britain, but particularly if you look at the exporting sector. Of course, an awful lot of British companies are exporters because, you know, it's a small island after all. So a lot of them are exporters. They are helped with the low British pound. The low British pound, of course, means that those stocks are cheaper, less expensive for dollar-based investors, which gets to your point why US companies don't buy more British companies. So, you know, I think that's a good pull to fish in, if you want. But I would be looking
If you could choose UK stocks, if I could jump in, sorry, Adrian. If you could choose UK stocks that are global sellers, that actually are pound hedges, because I'm not too overconfident about the journey path of the pound as well as the economy. In other words, they're not reliant on domestic income, and they draw a lot of their income from BRICS nations and other outside. I think you get a pound hedge factor with that as well if they are selling Those could be very, very interesting caps, which are, and very lowly rated, as you've suggested. Because, I mean, just at the numbers, the FTSE is 7.5, essentially 7.570. You're talking about a 9.3% increase since 99, and we're in 23. So you're almost at a quarter of a century. You're 20, going on 24 years, and you've done 10% in an environment. When I first arrived, you got a pint for 80p in London, and the very expensive place is £1. And in Nottingham, you were still paying 50p. And now I think you're paying a fiver in the Midlands, possibly. And I don't even know. I think you can spend more than £5 to secure a pint in a upmarket London pub nowadays. Now, that's a bit of a crude benchmark. It's far from the McDonald index itself, a crude benchmark. But if you think about the inflation that has truly gone on in Britain, and of course the currency factor that you also alluded on, it was round about 160s to 170s most of the time. And actually pre-2008, British pound traded 2.11, 2.11 to the US dollar. And now you're stuck with the pound, you know, struggling between the 1.2s and the 1.25s, and it's substantially down. So as I say, I'm just amazed that there hasn't been more M&A activity for big brands that have international markets.
Now, in fairness, when we look at the returns on the British market over 25 years, we should factor in the dividend yield, which is traditionally higher in the US than it is in many other markets. So that's been a factor. But yes, you're right. People who put everything into stocks had no income, just everything was in the stock market. They have lagged inflation. So basically a quarter percent, which is pretty astonishing. But, you know, again, I don't want to get into politics, I mean, unless you want to, but I have a feeling that once, if this Northern Ireland Protocol of Rishi Sunak passes Parliament, I don't think they've had to vote yet, have they, as we're talking? I think the vote was today.
No, I don't believe.
I think the vote's today. It strikes me that one of the most urgent things this government needs to do is do what Boris Johnson promised, you know, 7 years ago. Was that vote really? No. Was it really 7 years ago, the Brexit vote?
Yeah, but 16. Yeah.
Gosh. So one of the things that Boris Johnson promised to do, which was get some free trade agreements with different countries. And if Rishi Sunak can, and he said he's going to do it, if he can get some free trade agreements with different countries, that again will only boost the British exporters. So I definitely think there's some good value there. Again, I'm not going to go overboard on it. You know, if this was 2 years ago, I might be a little more aggressive. But right now, it's just a matter of selectively picking. And, you know, there's other sort of... you know, we just have to look for opportunities that may come along all the time. You know, we were buying some Canadian stocks just 2 months ago. I wouldn't be buying them today, as an example.
What industry did you like in there? Was that energies or mining?
In Canada? Well, we've got a lot of gold stocks in Canada. So we already have exposure to the country and we have exposure to the currency. So typically, because of that, I don't want to go overboard with buying other stocks. No, one of the stocks we were buying was something called Power Corp, which is a power company, but it's basically a holding company whose largest division is a power company run by good value investors, good dividend yield. Right now, maybe 3.5% dividend yield. A little bit more, you know, when we bought it on the decline, and a good conservative balance sheet. I should say in this environment, even though my whole focus in investing for 45 years has been global value and long term. I'm not quite as long-term as Warren Buffett, whose ideal holding time is forever, but I will rarely will I buy anything that I would not be happy owning if the stock market were closed. So Nestle, we mentioned. You know, Nestle was actually the very first company we bought when I started my money management firm in 1991. And even though we've done a little bit of trading around the edges, we still own that position today. That's unusual, but I mean, it's not alone. There are other stocks that we bought in the 90s that we still own today. But so I like to buy things, but I think I would be happy owning if I couldn't sell them. But of course, in this kind of environment, we do tend to be a little more short-term oriented.
Yes, and I think you might get opportunities to buy them even cheaper in any short-term dips that do smell like being not too far off in terms of our views. So I like the cash component. I would be pretty heavy cash right now outside of the military industrial complex on the long side, and I actually have a swathe of shorts, unfortunately, on the energy markets, but I think those will also become buyers after the usual solution of throwing money, as you called it, the quantitative easing, comes back into play.
And just when I finish that $1 million portfolio, I forgot to say we're also buying and pretty heavily already invested in Asia outside of China. I think one has to be very cautious about China because of what's going on with the U.S. I mean, there's people in the U.S. who seem to actually want a war with China. They need to be certifiable, in my opinion. But suddenly there's that high risk. And even if it doesn't come to actual, you know, guns blaring at each other, there'll be something at some point that will have the same impact that we saw, as you saw with the Russia stuff. So I'm very cautious on that. But Singapore, for example, would be my number one right now. And then we're also buying in other markets like Thailand. I think a lot of people assume, and I don't blame them, but when things are risky worldwide and you've got Credit Suisse basically defaulting, gosh, how can you even think about Thailand and Brazil? In fact, sometimes the smaller markets do hold up a lot better in that kind of environment, particularly if the dollar is falling, and particularly if you have inflation. We do have inflation, and I think the odds are the dollar will decline. I'm not waiting for a crash, but the dollar will be lower a year or two from now. So some of these smaller markets are actually quite attractive right now. I don't know if you want. I'm not suggesting anybody buy this. Yep. It's just an example. Yep. It's a Thai company. I'm just putting it up so I get the exact numbers. It's a
Thai water company,
and it's trading at 10 times earnings. It yields 7.3%. Okay, 7.3%.
That's good.
It's not so high, but you start to wonder if it's real. But if you look back at this company, they have paid the same dividend as far back as Bloomberg goes. The dividend every 6 months has been identical going back as long as Bloomberg goes. And so I think that yield in BART terms, anyway, BART terms,
yes,
is pretty solid. So we're looking for things like that.
I like Singapore. I see we've got a very big macro technical structure of upside on Singapore. I think it's going to become the sanitized Eastern Switzerland, only it's going to be the London and Switzerland. It's going to be London and Zurich in one. You've got the Indonesian demographics, which are very positive. You've got China, where people don't want to go into Beijing or Hong Kong. Very much like the Singapore. If I could,
it's a good dollar that's come to me.
Yes, you're going to get a double effect. You're going to get a currency effect and equities. I could see it being the home of a larger BRICS. If you wanted to know who I think the London, the financial market for the West, and of course shared a bit with New York and a tiny bit with maybe the German market. Frankfurt, for example, I would say that's going to be Singapore for the BRICS nations, because it's going to be in the middle of everything. It's very law orderly. I'm not sure I want to be there if there's ever another lockdown, live there. But in terms of order and financial probity, it's probably one of the better ones. Awesome for Frankfurt, one of the better ones.
Yeah, I was going to mention financial probity.
I also have a view that, and I'll finish with this, the Middle East, I think they're very small markets, but I get a feeling that Qatar, Saudi, over there, they really want to become a fulcrum, and they're sanitizing. You know, you had the steps taken by MBS, who's very dubious character, in my opinion, but to naturalize, the more westernize Saudi. They're trying to make that more fulcrum, and they, you know, I just respect people that invest money. Some of them waste it. But for example, Russia spent $18 billion on the World Cup. These guys spent $200 billion on the following World Cup. And you'll now see we have a Saudi Formula One. We have a lot of things that are taking place there. They're capturing the sport. They're trying to bring the Western and be this haven. They even got involved with this UFC, this is fighting franchise, when there was lockdowns. They're very much trying to capture it and get everyday people involved that are watching, you know, sports and things like that, but also the financial markets. I have a sense that there's early capital formation ambition there.
I agree completely. And of course, along with the sports, chicken and egg, as you said, liberalizing a few things like, you know, women can now drive in Saudi and you know, you could drink beer at the World Cup. I don't know, was it in your hotel or whatever? But things are opening up a little bit. And there's also, of course, a lot of capital, which is important, you know, with it may only be, you know, the top 1% of the population, but there are pools of capital, which is important for investment. And you're seeing it in all areas. Saudi Arabia, for example, you mentioned, is making a big pitch towards gold and copper companies. Barrick already operates a copper mine there. But then they held a conference last year to try to attract Western mining companies. So I think you're absolutely right there. Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah, good. Adrian, thank you for your time. How do people contact, stay in touch with you, your newsletters, engage with you if they're interested in services? Do give us the rundown.
Yeah, the easiest thing to do is the website is adrianday.com, one word, adrianday.com. And if you go there, you'll be pointed to a newsletter or you'll be pointed to the money manager.
Excellent. We'll pop that in the link details in the description below so that people that wish to engage further. Global macro, quite a pessimistic view. We've had a feast and now it's time for the famine. Are we summarizing it a bit like that, Adrian? Is it more about capital preservation and smart defense than overambition chasing growth?
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Adrian Day, thank you very much for your time. Look forward to a catch-up sometime in the future when we see what the narrative is that brings us future bargains to buy.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Adrian. Bye-bye for now.
Okay, bye.